This podcast is made possible by the patrons at patreon.com. To support the show, visit patreon.com/Keith Bergun. Hello, this is episode 8 of the Clockwork Game Design Podcast. In this episode, I'll be talking about building on structure. I've been a little bit sick, so I apologize if my voice sounds a little bit strange today. Today, I wanted to talk a little bit about structure and why structure is important for the creative arts, for crafts that are designed to express ideas to people, which I think most people would call art. I try to stay away from the word art because it has a lot of baggage, but basically we're talking about, forms of communication, be they stories or music or games or films or essays or even like tweets. We're taking some information and we're combining it in a certain way, we're arranging it in a certain way to send a message to those who read it on the other end. And that's basically my definition of art. I think it's pretty down to earth and simple, and I just think that's all it is, but that doesn't mean that it's simple to create. I think it's actually extremely hard to create good art that relays a lot of information as quickly as possible. I mean, that's what elegance is, using few strokes, few words, few rules to express a lot of information. Today, I'm just going to be talking about, structure in the arts, and because that's something that I feel like I can't talk about enough, because there are, not only do we not really focus enough on that, but there are actually forces pushing in the other direction. There are people who, like prominent people, thinkers, who are actively trying to get people to not build on form and not learn more guidelines for better structural design, but who are actually saying, improvising things is the height of human expression, and sort of random things and putting in things that are actually nonsense. I recently learned about a term called elliptical commentary or elliptical poetry, which, as best as I can find, means like literally saying things that don't make sense intentionally. There are a lot of these philosophies, these kind of like postmodern philosophies out there that I think are, actively in the way of people trying to make progress. And so, this is going to be definitely a recurring theme in all my writing and my podcast episodes. But, because I really want progress, and I think that this existential, anything goes kind of total subjectivity perspective is not helpful. And I think in particular in video games right now, because we're in such a kind of dark closet, like we don't really have a lot to go on in terms of structure, and, we just don't really know what we're doing. That kind of stuff has a bit more legs than it normally would. Like, for example, in film, I think people sort of understand the film medium. It's a little more mature, and storytelling as well is a lot more mature. And so people kind of get that. And so, the sort of existential postmodern people are relegated to a very, very tiny little corner of culture in film. And that is still true to an extent in video games, but it's not as true. And further, I'm not certain that it'll stay true. I think that things are kind of wishy-washy and open enough in video games and in games generally that those kinds of points of view kind of seem as relevant and useful and valid as kind of here is a guideline for making better design things. So, I think that's just something that we ought to be on the lookout for. So in the episode with Richard Turrell, I asked him a question, which was, what opinions of yours have changed significantly in the last few years? Because I do think that's an important thing, to be able to change your opinion, especially with something like this, where we're exploring kind of uncharted territory, and we're going to be discovering new things. And so we probably shouldn't have the same points of view that we had when we were 15. If we do, I think that's problematic. And I will say that I have encountered numerous game designers who aged ranged, you know, 30 to like 50, who basically really both seem to be still trying to pursue what they were trying to pursue when they were 15 years old. Either they seem like they're doing that, or they actually come out and actively say that they're doing that. You know, I think that's a negative thing. I don't think we should be, I think we should be growing, you know, and I don't think we should, if what you experienced when you were 15 is still the peak of game design for you and what the possibility of what games can be, I think that shows a lack of, almost certainly, I can't say with 100% certainty, perhaps, you know, you just figured it out when you were 15 years old. But that doesn't seem likely to me. It seems more likely that you would be wowed by spectacles, as young people are, and that you would have like a magical kind of experience, but that, you know, there is probably things that we can do a lot better than those magical experiences that you have and that you have a lot of nostalgia tied up in. And, you know, I have nostalgia for video games too. And I feel like I struggled with that through my 20s. At this point, I feel like I'm actually kind of mostly over it. In fact, I had a gigantic video game collection at my house because I worked at a Funko Land. I don't know if anyone remembers that, but I actually worked at a Funko Land. It was just bought by GameStop when I worked there in like the early 2000s. And so what that meant was they were getting rid of all of that old, you know, old NES, Genesis, all those old retro systems. So on the one hand, they were getting rid of all that stuff and I got to just like take it all. And I thought it was great at the time. And on the other hand, people would still be bringing stuff in thinking it's Funko Land. They'd come in with all this stuff that to them is like mostly garbage, a lot of them. And they would be like, hey, can I sell this to you? And I'm like, sorry, we're a GameStop now. We don't take it anymore. But I'll take it for 50 cents or whatever. So I ended up having a very, very large video game collection in my house. And it stayed there for, we spent years playing all these old Atari games. And I got a ColecoVision. And I got just all this crazy stuff. Kind of like I was dabbling with being a collector. I never went full collector, but I had a lot of stuff. You know, I think it was like this last year that I think I just got rid of the last of my old video games. I've just been selling them all. Interestingly enough, there's a new place that opened up by me that is kind of a lot like Funko Land. And I've gotten rid of all that stuff. And, you know, I think that I'm part of the reason is, I mean, first of all, if I ever want to play these things, you know, I can always play them on emulators. But the thing is, I've had them on emulators for like the last 10 years and I haven't wanted to play them. I had a big phase, you know, in the late 2000s and mid 2000s where I did play a lot of emulator games and old games and really just caught up on all that stuff. And, you know, it's just not, there's very few games that I think are interesting enough for like an adult to actually captivate an adult's attention for very long without that nostalgia and all that stuff. So anyway, my point is, I think I'm like mostly over the nostalgia. And this is kind of a little bit of a side thing to my major point here. What I was trying to get at is just, we should be able to be flexible, intellectually flexible. And so my views have changed a lot over the last few years. You know, I wrote a book in 2012, and some of the things in that book, I think I need to update them. But for the most part, it's basic thing, and my basic thing has stayed the same for about the past, I would say, 5 to 8 years. And that basic thing comes from my understanding. You know, I studied music composition in school, and I also do some visual art, and I dabble in a lot of like creative arts. And what I've picked up in these other fields is that they all have like these formal structural guidelines for how to make them better. And like, there's just patterns that we've figured out. And I've just noticed that in video games, we don't have that yet. And So that's what I've been trying to pursue. And that's been consistent for me, is that I'm trying to pursue useful, you know, criteria. And that's what this podcast is about. And my basic idea that, like, the form, the actual properties of the thing, the rules, the lines, the shapes, the colors, the notes, that those things, you know, matter, because those are what we're dealing with. Those are the tools that we have. It's like that somebody asked me that question at practice. Isn't it about the experience and not about the form? Yeah, but the form is how we affect the experience. That's our hands in the surgery, if you will, you know? And so obviously we are pursuing an experience ultimately, but we can't directly impact experience. We have to do it through form. Today, I said that this episode's about building on structure. What I mean by that is you can take a piece, any piece, and sort of tack something onto the end of it or into the middle of it that's kind of unrelated, and it doesn't help the other parts of the piece. Like, it doesn't add to the value of those things. So for example, if, you know, halfway through this podcast episode, I started talking about ornithology, the study of birds. So, you know, for the first half, I'm talking about, you know, game design stuff. And then the second half, I'm just talking about ornithology. Those two things are so unrelated to each other that they don't have any like information tendrils connecting to each other. So I'd basically be starting a new podcast when I started the ornithology part. It'd be starting from scratch because there's not a lot in common between these two concepts. So I'm talking about game design. I'm talking about all these formal things. I'm talking about goals and structure and all this stuff. And then I switch gears and I start talking about birds and different kinds of exotic birds or whatever. And those two just general concepts don't have anything really in common. So it's really just a case of slapping two independent systems next to each other. They play one after the other, but they don't have anything really in common. They don't build off of each other. And so there is no value really added by me smushing these two things together. They don't complement each other, and they don't become something greater than the sum of their parts. That's kind of a big point that I'm trying to make here. Stories, if, for example, you know, a story was constantly introducing new characters, or, you know, halfway through we found some other like mini story that's not really related to the main story, and it never really did connect to the main story. That's, again, another situation where you have two independent, fully formed systems of information that don't communicate with each other, and so they don't add up to more than the sum of their parts. So in this way, when you don't take advantage of structure like that, it's really kind of wasteful, because what's happening is that, you know, we can look at like the depth meter, the you know, how much like value is being given. And when we start over, either talking about ornithology or whatever it is, the depth meter kind of just flattens out and goes back down to zero, and we have to build up again from scratch. So That's like a kind of a basic point that I want to make with this episode. So I'm going to come back to that in a minute, but I want to talk a little bit about games, strategy games, and how they work, because that's also required for what I'm talking about. So I talked about the four forms in the last episode, I think, and the fourth form is, I call it games. You could call it strategy games or contests of decision making. And this form is, you know, we're making decisions in this little system, and each decision changes the state, and eventually we lead towards a goal. And the goal is like an anchor. Like, you could think of it like being this big map, and the goal doesn't move. The goal is staying steady. And every time you make a decision, you are moving either closer to or further away from that goal. The value of every decision is sort of with relative meaning to the goal. So that's why, like, everything is informed by the goal and by the win or loss condition. So if you were to win a game, that kind of sends this positively charged message back down the line of decisions that you made all the way to the beginning of the game. Whereas if you were to lose, it sends a negatively charged thing throughout the whole thing. Now, that doesn't mean that every decision that you made on the way there is bad, but it informs every decision on the way there. So it's like a starting point. It's funny, actually, the goal is kind of the starting point in terms of what we are looking for in games. Now, I should talk about the primary fundamental value of games, which is learning or understanding this system. And I use the term understanding, and it's gaining like a little bit more mastery is all it is over the system. So the way that we can like best do that is by using the whole game. So when we, after we've played a game, we win or we lose, and then we kind of like, we think about like, what are the things that like went, led up to that win or loss. And that win or loss information, even though it's only binary, it informs everything that came before it. And so that's, it's like, that's why I'm saying it's like our starting point is the win or loss. Now imagine that halfway through the game, there's just a reset. You know, everything kind of goes back to zero. So with regards to this understanding thing, what we want is for every decision and every kind of decision point to have tendrils that connects back as far as possible. That's like really where game's depth comes from, is like this, you know, reaching back through time, that this happened, then this happened, then that caused this, then that caused this, then that caused this. I decided this, therefore this, therefore this, therefore this. And so you want as many of those like therefores as possible. Actually, to go back to stories for a minute, Matt Stone and Trey Parker, who are the creators of the show South Park, I think they're kind of very formalist in their understanding of storytelling. And they did this talk where they talked about the importance of therefore and but, as opposed to and then. In a story, you can have a bunch of events that are like, you know, this guy went to the store, and then he did this, and then he did that, and then he did this. What Matt Stone and Trey Parker are talking about in this video, which I'll link in the show notes, is how what you really want is therefore. This guy went to the store, therefore he had less money. Therefore, when the robber tried to steal his money, he didn't have any, and so he kidnapped him. Therefore, he was on this road. And, you know, so the issue there with the therefore as opposed to and then is that we want the every event to be like necessarily causally connected to each other. And so with and then, it's kind of like, and there was then another thing. And it's kind of like switching over to the orthonology thing. It's just like, here's another piece of information. Here's another piece of information that aren't necessarily connected or causally related to each other. And so it's funny that, like, I think that, you know, storytelling in that way, that's a good metaphor for what I'm trying to say with game design. You want as many things to be, and you know, therefore this, therefore that in games, because, you know, that means that the meaning of any given decision has ramifications throughout the whole system. And so we're getting the most depth possible from whatever, however many turns the game has, however many rules the game has. Everything is as interconnected as possible, and therefore as deep as possible and as elegant as possible. So it's not just arbitrary for me to be like, oh, well, the goal is this fundamental thing. The goal is fundamental because it's the ending of a system. So you can have, you know, you could have there be, you know, some people talked about like letting players play a little bit after you win in Oro, which is my single player score based game. So you have to get a certain amount of points and then you win. And players are kind of not really used to, first of all, they're not used to single player games as in contests of decision making in the first place, but they're especially sort of not used to, you know, you're playing and you're playing and you're playing and you suddenly you win and then the match is over. They kind of feel like they should just keep being able to play until they die. But what happens is, because all of these decisions are being made up until the point of the goal, that's one contained system, and all those decisions are being made with respect to that goal. And then that goal happens, and that really ends the system. And then we have a new system after that, and it's like basically starting from scratch. And you know, not to mention in the case of Oro, it has no goal, so it becomes like this weird toy thing. And there's all kinds of problems with that example. But My point is, there's a lot of games actually that that I would say kind of reset their game state, and they're not building on the time and the turns and the elements that they have adequately. An example I'll talk about is Super Smash Brothers. I've been playing a little bit of the newest one. All of the Smash Brothers games have this same problem in that they have lives. And what's really weird about lives is, let's say, and this is a pretty common scenario, you and I are fighting, blah, 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 I kill you, and I have really high damage, so you come back, and then you kill me, right? And now we're both down one stock, which is their word for lives. But other than that, the game state is basically identical to when we started. And if we had started with, you know, two stock instead of three stock, it would have been a starting point. So the problem there is that there's not enough like larger arc things that are happening that take advantage of the long length of a Smash Brothers match. Now, one, you know, technically the solution to this could just be make everything be one stock. I'm not sure that's the best answer. That might actually be the best answer. But in a practical sense, I think that sort of makes it too clear how shallow the game is, because, you know, it really makes it too obvious that there's, it's just like, you got to just like land those hits. And if you're the one to land those first few hits, you know, I think people kind of sense that it's a little bit loose and a little bit random, and kind of anyone can win one stock. And so that's why people like to do 2, 3, 4 stock. Basically, I think the stock system is like playing a bunch of matches of poker, because, you know, it is kind of random. Even I'm not talking about items or stage hazards or anything like that. I'm just talking about because there's so much execution involved. And, you know, if you and I are right next to each other and we both want to do a smash attack, like one or whatever, or one person wants to dodge, there's like very little either of us can do to like ensure that our hit hits. I've talked about this a little bit before, but basically it's effectively random who's going to come out on top of like a you're in my face, I'm in your face, we're fighting, slap fight, and then someone just flies away, and the person who that is, as far as the players are concerned, is basically random. So I'm not really advocating, because of that problem, I'm not really advocating for one stock, but I'm trying to illustrate that that the game just doesn't take advantage of form. People don't think about that the game kind of resets, and then we're like back to square one. The match complexity is like at zero. Once, you know, I kill you, you kill me, we're both like, maybe our positions are a little bit different from the starting position, but that's about it. Other than that, it's completely identical to the match start. And, you know, so that's, is that a problem? I would say it's more like a lost opportunity. It's more like a lesson, a learning, a teachable moment about, you know, game design and how we can look for those kinds of moments in other games. I've talked a little bit before in my violence articles about actor removal and how removing characters from play has a similar effect. Well, and actually in Smash Brothers, that's literally what's happening. But when you remove characters from play entirely, which is, you know, unfortunately, the basic language of video games thus far has mostly been about, like, you know, killing. And when you kill or blow up something, it disappears from play. And that means that all of its complexity that it was bringing to the system is now gone. And it's like bringing us a little bit closer to like a reset point. So, you know, that's something to just be aware of. I'm not saying that you can't do actor removal, but I am saying, you know, maybe instead of removing actors, you could have actors, when they're killed, they turn into something different, you know, and so they're still informing the game state. In fact, just in the last couple of weeks, for the big 2.0 release version of Oro that we're doing, we just introduced a rule, which I've been thinking about for a while, but I didn't feel quite comfortable doing it until now. But when you bump monsters into the water, Oro is a single player, you know, tactical game where you're walking around on this little randomly generated grid, and the grid is surrounded by water. And the old rule was you bump a monster into the water, he falls into the water and he's dead. He's gone. He's just removed from play. Now what happens is when you bump that monster into the water, he becomes a tile. So he creates a tile. So he's still informing the game state. And I'm not saying that that's even ideal. Maybe there's a better way we can do that, even that makes him even more influencing the game state. You know, like my point is that when we're introducing all this complexity to the game, as in new monsters or new weapons or new challenges or whatever, don't just like knock them back down and then reset to the zero point. That's something to just really be aware of. I think that's a good guideline, is are you using the information that you're bringing into the game, or are you just depleting it and just, you know, getting rid of it, like as soon as it comes into the state. I've also talked about randomness, and specifically output randomness, and how that has a similar like severing of the system effect. So if we go back to that like goal and all the decisions that led up to that goal, random events like, you know, a random miss, you know, like you roll the die, you try to attack this person, you roll the die and you miss. And now the system is heading in some other direction because, not because of your decisions, but because of the random dice roll. And so what that does is that line of causality, like decision-based causality, is now getting cut and taken in some other direction because of randomness. And like, I'm not against randomness in games. I think that games actually need randomness, but they need it to be pushed back far enough so that players will, first of all, have a basic idea of what their decisions are going to do, but also their decisions, we want to preserve that decision line, that causality line as much as possible, and have the things that are happening be because of player decisions, not because of random events. Now, I do talk about input randomness and the information horizon, so that there's some point at which random information is coming into the game, whether it be from the other player or whether it be from an RNG or whatever. But there is random information entering into the game space. The key is to have that be far enough out that players can make decisions and the outcomes of those decisions, and you know where this little curvy arc is heading is player driven. It's driven by the player's choices, not by I wanted to attack that thing, but it just didn't work because the die rolled low. Those dice rolls that change what players even do is a lot like "and then" in a story. It's random. It's not related to anything else. Like the fact that the die rolled a 1 instead of a 6 is not because of anything else in the system. It's random. It's by design. It's totally random, and it doesn't have any connection to anything else. Whereas player decisions, when players decide to do this and then this and then this, this caused this, this caused this, this caused this, that is not random. That's based on player decisions. And again, what we're trying to measure is player decisions. And so when we keep that, we preserve that causal line, it lets players analyze their play and get the most depth out of a system. So what we want, to kind of summarize a little bit, is one system, starting in the beginning and ending with the goal, that is as like causally uninterrupted as possible. We don't want there to be like some big mini game in the middle that isn't really related to anything else. That's kind of a waste of time. That doesn't add anything more than the sum of the parts of the mini game plus the sum of the parts of the other game. We also don't want to sever things or reset things halfway through a match. We just want one uninterrupted smooth line. And in order to make that not solvable, and in order to make that those decisions ambiguous, you do probably need to have hidden information, also to not allow players just infinite look ahead as they have in abstracts such as chess and go. You want to cut off the amount of calculation that they're able to do, and that's what an information horizon is good for. But within that information horizon, you want everything to be as causal and as reason-based and as decision-based as possible. And by doing that, you're building this one system that is every element, no element in it is wasted. That's like a really big point, is that you're using all the parts you have to the best that you can. And to go back to that Ouro example, you know, monsters becoming tiles is doing a little bit more with monsters than if they just disappear. You know, in the case of Smash Brothers, I could imagine, and someday maybe I'd like to make a game like this, that's sort of like a fighting-y kind of thing that's similar, but you're adding things to the map as time goes on. So you're like, you're adding like a little like a bumper, and you're adding this and that. And I guess you could say items kind of do that, but items for one thing are totally random, very poorly balanced. And whereas I'm sort of advocating these wouldn't be like things that randomly appear. They'd be like your moves. Your moves are like create a vortex thing that pulls people, create a bumper thing that does these things, and all the positions of those is being added to throughout the match and being moved and all that sort of stuff. So now you have these longer arcs. So we're looking at the match as like one system. And I talk a lot about how video games are broken toys, and video games are very much toy-like. But I think that also video games have a contest-y element to them, which is, you know, contests aren't like games in the way I've been talking about them. You can cut them off at any time. You know, you can set the limitation at any point. They're not as structural as games. So they're a linear measurement. You know, they're not with respect to one particular goal. It's just how much can you do in X time. So, you know, a hot dog eating contest, if you told people, okay, you have 2 minutes to eat as many hot dogs as you want, but then you cut them off at 1 minute, you'd be getting a kind of a reasonable measurement of who is doing the best hot dog eating. Maybe an even better example would be something like darts. You know, so everyone gets to, I don't know the rules of darts, or no, let's take golf. Let's say golf, because I do know golf a little better. So, you know, you assume you have 18 holes in golf, right? And after 18 holes, whoever has the best score wins. But let's say after hole 6, I stop the match and I say, okay, we're cutting it off here. Whoever has a better score now wins. And that works fine. I mean, like, or you could do 19 holes or 100 holes or one hole. What I'm saying is that contests tend to be this kind of linear measurement where and that's why it makes sense in contests to have first place, second place, third place, fourth place. Whereas it doesn't make sense in a strategy game. Now, the reason that you can't do that kind of stuff in a strategy game is there are things like sacrifice plays. And, you know, if you cut off the match halfway through in, I don't know, some game that has victory points, let's say, like Puerto Rico is one of my favorite Euro board games. And if you cut off the match halfway through, that might actually really be unfair and not make a lot of sense because someone might have been making like a sacrifice play. They might have been, you know, making sort of an econ strategy where they're weak early game, but then they have this late game, super strong push, and they are doing these decisions with regards to a known end game state. And so to sort of change that on the fly on them is just really not fair. And similarly, it's also not fair to assess people beyond first place in games. So you know, first place makes sense. Second place does not make sense anymore. You can't be like, there aren't places in a game. And perhaps that's an episode in and of itself. But you can't do like second place doesn't make sense in a strategy game. Because we were doing everything with regards to this one goal. And, you know, all players have to agree to that goal to start. Like, that's sort of a basic premise of playing games is, okay, here are the rules. And the rule says the goal is be the player with the most points at the end of the game. That's not just me being like, oh, a stickler for the rules or something. That's like actually fundamentally important. If someone is going for second place, that's no different than someone going for last place. You know, going for last place, obviously everyone would know you're just like basically trolling the game. You're not really playing. But going for second place is exactly the same thing. You're not doing, you're basically not playing by the same rules as everyone else. And so the idea of going for second place makes no sense. And so if we're all going for, we all agree to go for first place and only one person gets it, it doesn't matter if you're in second or third, because, you know, the objective wasn't to get second. The objective was to get first. And again, that's not just being semantic, a stickler, but that is actually fundamentally important because, you know, again, they might have been going for some econ strategy, and that made them, you know, have a little bit lower score than the second place guy. But it doesn't matter. The point was they needed to be at, you know, first place by the end of the match, and they weren't. So, I mean, we can very easily say players should all be trying for the same thing. They should all be, you know, playing by the same rules. And the other thing is you really need that binary win-loss condition to inform the decisions going back through to the beginning, because you were going for this one thing. So did these decisions take you there or did they not? It's once you start getting into second place, third place, it becomes like really, really hard to tell if second place is actually even better than third place, because neither of them got the goal. Maybe third place is lower than second place, but maybe actually, you know, there's something structurally a lot better about his strategy, actually. And, you know, many more percentage of the time, those moves will actually lead you to be in first place more often than the second place strategy. Because, again, like it's some econ strategy or something. So it's very hard to, that's the other reason, is that, you know, the fact that you happen to have the second most VPs at the end of the game, That doesn't really necessarily say anything. Now, and one thing I will say is, going back to this games as contests thing, is that a lot of video games and maybe even things like Puerto Rico, a lot of games, a lot of strategy games are built in such a way that they're kind of homogenous, and they're kind of, you actually kind of can assess them a little bit on those fronts, because they don't have enough structure. They are a little bit just do the same thing over and over again, a little bit like a contest. I mean, Smash Brothers is certainly like that. If, you know, let's say we do a 15 stock match or something between two players, and then we, you know, halfway through the match, we're like, okay, well, guys, when someone gets, you know, at the 5 minute mark, we're just gonna see who has fewer lives. And that kind of makes sense, actually, in Smash Brothers, because there aren't these larger arcs that would allow someone to do like an early game sacrifice. That doesn't make sense in Smash Brothers. You know, a lot of games like that are score based or lives based, they kind of are linear and they kind of are contesty, and you kind of can cut them off. And, you know, first, second, fourth, third place, those kinds of ideas kind of make more sense. So what I'll end with is saying that to the extent that a strategy game is elegant and well-designed, the idea of second, third place make less and less sense. And the other big point from this episode, the big takeaway, is utilizing form. Whatever information you have in your game, whatever rules and game state information is there, use it as best as you can. Don't just discard it and then bring in new stuff. You want things to be kind of all informing the game state throughout, and building on that structure that you already have. You don't want a reset. You don't want an and then. You want a therefore. And that's really what I want to see more of in strategy game design, and that's what I'm going to be pursuing on my own. So that's about all I have to say on this topic. Sorry if my voice sounded a little weird, but thank you so much for listening, and I'll see you next time. If you've enjoyed this podcast, please consider becoming a patron by going to www.patreon.com/KeithBurgun. Thanks for listening.